yet you know each person there. We ask for your blessing and protection on Anne, but also that you'd use her for your glory and grow her up through this experience and bring her home safely. Thank you for George and Blossom and their fellowship with us here as well, and for Mercy and for their whole family. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you, George, for letting us know that. Lambert, good to see you vertical, as always.
And good morning, everybody. We have been running through the last half of Genesis. It's a lot of chapters, it turns out. 38 chapters, I think, compared to the first part of Genesis. If you remember the big program that we find in Genesis is that after the time period from the creation of Adam and Eve down to the flood is a time period with no particular organized program for God reaching the world or bringing people to himself. We have an awful lot of individuals who would have come into a relationship with God. We don't have any large extended families that we know of that would be believers until we get up to the man Abraham, whom we met here in Genesis. Abraham lived about 2,200 years ago, and God called him from Southern California to go over across the Mojave Desert to Southern Arizona. Where did God call him from?
Ur.
From Ur, which is Southern Iraq. And he was there with his family, and they were from the tribe of Shem. You remember Noah's three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And the Semitic people from Shem are given the task of worrying about the world religions and world spirituality and the people that, through whom God was going to speak and through whom the Messiah would come. So we find Abraham and his whole family devoutly serving the God of their fathers when the story opens. Is that right? No, not right. We find God calls Abraham, at which time his family had all lapsed into the prevailing paganism of the whole country. That's part of ancient Babylon. And after the flood, the family of man coming down off the ark began to multiply. In fact, they began to multiply and unify to such an extent that God split the world up into different languages to encourage dispersion, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, rather than build a great tower and focus all of your efforts in getting into outer space or something like that. And Abraham was a bright young man out of college when God called him. Is that right? No. How old was he? 70. And he with his father and the family headed out to the west. They went west, young man. But they didn't make it all in one fell swoop over to the land that is now Israel. They stopped up in northern Iraq at the family homestead for previous years at Haran and hung out there 5 years until Abraham's father died. And then God again spoke to the man, and they packed up, and there was a freight train that ran that big loop then. And so they caught the freight train with their animals, right? No. No trains, no cars, no buses, no airplanes. It's all on foot, and particularly if you've got animals, it's a long, slow, tedious journey. You've got to watch out for water, the robbers along the way. There's all kinds of people traveling that caravan route that comes up out of Iraq and makes a big arc through northern Turkey and descends on down into what is now Palestine. About 400 miles, perhaps. An hour by jet, but months on foot. No internet, no television at night. They didn't even have the King James Bible quite yet, and so the only knowledge they had of God would have been passed on down verbally from father to son. Around the campfire at night, you look up at the stars, and the patriarch could tell the story of the constellations, how they pointed to the coming of a redeemer for the human race. And then whatever information had been passed on down to the family was supposed to be passed on down faithfully, accurately, carefully to the next generation. Obviously, it hadn't been happening very much with the whole family forgetting about God. And so God's awakening Abraham and sends him out here with no particular goal. He just says, go out to the west. And what did God tell you? What was the idea, the incentive? Go out, I'm going to give you this big chunk of land out there. And you can settle out there. Well, of course, there's a lot of other people living out there. We're not told that right away. A bunch of Canaanites and Philistines and other people that are living in the land. So it's not like it's dry, a barren country with nobody else there. Abraham obeys. In fact, Abraham is set out for us right away as an example of kind of person that we need to emulate to the nth degree, because he illustrates what it means to
walk by
faith. Walk by faith. To trust God, to act on what God has declared is true, whether or not you have the visible evidence or not. And his whole life is an example of walking by faith. Now, he was pretty well perfect. He didn't make any mistakes, any to speak of. Right? He made some big, bad mistakes. And they propagated on down through the family. And we see a very real picture of all the consequences of sin. He and his wife didn't have any children, and that was a consternation to them. But at the age of 100, God finally gave them the long-awaited son, whose name was Isaac. And there's some other sons come along on the that are not in that main line. There's another son, Ishmael, who comes from Hagar, Abraham's wife's maidservant. So it's a complicated family tree by the time we get down to the end of Genesis. There's all kinds of people that are related to Abraham. But the purpose of calling Isaac is so that the inheritance that God is going to give to Abraham should pass on down to subsequent generations. In particular, God has a program for all the rest of history, which consists of two classes of believers, two groups of believers that are to enter into covenants with God and be blessed by God and to learn how to walk with faith. These two groups of believers are North Dakota, South Dakota?
Yeah.
No. Two big classes, groups. Israel and the church. We're so saturated with having lived for 2,000 years in the age of the church that we forget that there was a whole 1,500 years before we ever were on the scene here when God was dealing with the nation of Israel, the immediate blood descendants of Abraham. And they had a covenant relationship with God. And then Jesus invented the idea of the church, not as an afterthought, but as a way of extending his gospel to the whole world. And we're coming near the end of the age of the church. And what happens next in history? Just sideline. The movie ends and we just all go out. The church is called out. Israel is brought back to the center stage of history, restored into their relationship with God, which they forgot all about. And then Jesus will come back to the earth and restore the whole earth, which gets pretty well destroyed in the last war. Right? So that's all Genesis. Now, what I'm getting out of this is the humanity, the real character of all of the people we're meeting here. They're flawed. They've got a character faults, and the Old Testament tends to not sweep them under the carpet. So we get to see these people as real individuals, how they coped with life, and right away how kind and gracious and faithful God is in taking care of them. Last week we went quickly through chapter 29 because I've skipped over the fact that Abraham had a son whose son's name was Isaac, and Isaac got a wife. The way he got a wife was the senior servant of the family took the camel journey of 10 camels over that long journey back to Haran, to the home country, and stopped at a well, and a beautiful young lady came out and watered the camels, which was a significant sign. And that was the chosen wife for Isaac. And with a very short negotiation, she agreed to travel back and sight unseen marry this man, Isaac, who was just a youth. How old a youth?
40.
Yeah. But they're going to live a little longer back there. Okay, so they get married, and then they have a little trouble having kids for a while. They try to have children, but can't up until another 20 years, isn't it? So that Isaac's 60. Can you imagine that? It's a little not at all what we're used to. And they happen to have twins. What about these two twins? Their names are? Jacob and Esau, and they're really a lot alike. They're best buddies. Very, very different. By temperament, by just, you can see that environment isn't going to play a huge role in that what kind of people they develop into. It's born with into them. Their character is, that's the way they're born. Because Esau is a country boy who likes to hunt and fish and hunt game. And he's an outdoor man, and he's rough and tough like his dad. And his brother is likes to watch Grand Opera in the evening on television. And he cooks a lot with his mother and helps with the dishes faithfully. Of course, all men are supposed to do that. But he has different needs. A visionary, on the other hand, and he's just not interested in the things his older brother is. But nevertheless, he's the one that God has chosen. And there's a big conflict right away. And the conflict starts right away when their boys are young and growing up. And right away we find that the most biggest fault in Jacob is
stealing.
Deception. Oh, deceiving. Absolutely. He's a deceiver. He manipulates, he lies, he's conniving, he knows how to go around the rules to get what he wants out of life. And he does that real early on with his older brother by cheating his older brother out of the birthright by cooking up a pot of stew for his older brother and his dad and family. And so bargains with his brother, who's all tired and hunting, and gives away the birthright and a hunger pang. And that's a cause of great resentment between the boys starting then, and that resentment's going to build up through their whole lives as they grow up together. In fact, that's where we're going to essentially really get going here today. Jacob's life is not terribly eventful, as you read it in Genesis. He wanders around the country and digs some wells, and he has a wonderful experience at Bethel, where he has a vision from God, and God confirms to him that the covenant that God made with Abraham has been passed on down to him, and all of the consequences, all of the details of that covenant have been included. And so everything that God promised Abraham is now going to pass on to his son. And that's it. And it's made clear that it's not Ishmael who receives the blessings. It's none of the other members of the family. It's this one boy. And covenants are the way God does things. With the covenant that God made with Abraham and with Isaac and with Jacob, that covenant is an unconditional covenant, in that man's failure doesn't nullify the covenant totally, thankfully. In other words, you can make a bad mistake and go back and get forgiveness, and the covenant still stays in force, though it might have some consequences of your messing up. Okay, Jacob, sort of uneventful life. We meet him planting wells around the country, and where are we? Richard? Oh, now we got to get Jacob grows up, and we got to get a wife for him. Now, the servant that did the wife hunting the first time is gone. He probably died by now. So how do we get a wife, and why do we have to look for a particular kind of wife? Not by looks. We're supposed to, last week it got so wonderfully lively in here, and we had to get riot squad, and everybody's supposed to jump in. Oh, see, this guy desperately needs exercise.
I think George said that his mom sent him, yeah, because it was trying to save Jacob from Esau's wrath.
Absolutely. These two boys, now grown men, got into a great big knockdown, drag-out fight, and it was one or the other, and mother said, son, you better get out of here, because I think your brother really means it this time. And the family decides they better not just send him to the next town, and so they send him back to be with his relatives in Haran. So he's got to go that long journey by himself. And meanwhile, what happens to Esau? He takes a wife or two and goes, moves a little bit away, and causes no end of problems for mom and dad, because these wives are Canaanite wives and they're cantankerous and difficult and not well behaved. Okay, now, Jacob heads over to, he ends up at a well of all places. We have a lot of things going on at wells here in this book. And then what happens at the well? A beautiful girl comes down a second time and waters all the animals.
No,
not quite. Same place. Maybe it's the same well that his mother had been at, but it's the same kind of a pattern, that God picks out the right wife. Now, why in the world is it so important that you marry within the family? We don't insist on that, hardly anymore, but there's a good reason for it biblically.
There's a lineage running through this.
That's right. There is a lineage and a family tree that's been mapped out ahead of time. That's right. With that family tree and that lineage goes something important. Or supposed to. Is it the biological family tree that matters most? No. It's the spiritual family tree that's supposed to be passed on down. And it's supposed to be believer always marrying believer. Always, without exception. Because the truth about God, that all of the things, that the content of our faith is to be transmitted down through families. Families are to be governed by the laws and rules of the Bible. But back then, they didn't know all the details from the scripture, but they nevertheless were obeying it. Okay, Jacob goes on over to chapter 29. We went along with, I read that real quick last week. Jacob ends up over at Haran's ranch, and they introduce themselves and realize that they're relatives, and Uncle Laban is a kind, gentle, wonderful guy, and he's just got a great heart and a big, big ranch. Not quite. but they introduce each other, and Uncle Laban says, hang around for a month or so, and while you're here, I'll put you to work. And that's not why Jacob wants to stay, because he's already fallen in love with this beautiful woman, because the first three women in this family are gorgeously beautiful. Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel are all just incredibly lovely women. And so he makes a deal. What is Jacob going to work for, and for how long, and what's he going to get? How many shekels per day or whatever?
Rachel, for 7 years.
Okay, work for me for 7 years, and then I'll give you my daughter, Rachel. Well, that's a pretty good deal, yeah.
And unlike Isaac, Jacob arrives without all the big wedding gifts to easily transact the acquisition of his wife.
Yes, yes. Remember that
in the quickly, that's why.
The previous generation. What was that?
He had to leave quickly.
Oh, he had to leave quickly, yeah.
He didn't bring anything.
That's right. So So that's a pretty good deal. Jacob's there. He's broke. He's got to work for something, board and room. Plus, he gets a wife. And so he works for 7 long, hard years taking care of the flocks. That would be sheep and goats. I don't know if there are any cattle mentioned here. There are cattle later on in the history of Israel, but mostly we can say sheep and goats. And 7 years go by, and they have a wonderful, great, big wedding celebration, a Middle Eastern wedding. And it went with the dancing and the merrymaking and a little too much wine. And then they all get settled down for the night and go into their tents. And Jacob goes to sleep with this lovely lady, only to wake up in the morning and find that it is not Rachel. Who is it?
Leah.
Who is she?
Older sister.
Older, quite a bit older sister. Now, it says she has weak eyes, but in the Hebrew doesn't. It just says.
That means not so pretty.
Not, it probably means not so pretty.
Hard on the eyes.
But then that's this problem we all have: a man looks on the outward appearance, and God looks upon the heart. So what matters to God is what's inside, and we tend to be captivated by outward beauty and outward appearances. So Jacob is pretty upset in the morning, and so he goes to Laban, who's always honest, forthright. He's not. He's a manipulator, a conniver. This runs in the family, and these two guys are birds of a feather. They're both manipulative in the family, and out to get what they want for themselves. So in the morning, we have Jacob very angry, and he goes to his uncle and he says, "Hey, you cheated me. I really wanted to marry Rachel, and you gave me your older sister." And Laban says, explains it very straightforward by saying,
"Oldest
got to
get married first."
Oh, it's an old custom. You know all about this old custom. The oldest daughter has the privilege of getting married first. But I'll make a deal with you. Work another 7 years, and I will give you the other. I'll give you Rachel.
This time, you can trust me.
This time, you can trust me. That's an old story, isn't it? So he makes that deal. So when does he get Rachel?
In a week.
When the contract for the wedding is all worked out, the year's up and everything, and that wedding with Leah is all set in concrete, now we can add the next wife. Okay? Now what? What happens next? This is the whole family tree of Israel. Leah keeps having children, and Rachel doesn't have any.
It's the battle of the matriarchs.
It's a battle of the matriarchs, and as John Mobley pointed out to us here, that the women oftentimes they end up with the right to name the children and to give them names that fit what mother really wanted all along. Leah is not loved by her husband to any great degree, and it breaks her heart, and God makes up for that by being a loving father to provide for her, so that in the long run, Leah is going to feel very, very loved with God in the picture and with her special children.
Including Judah.
Including Judah, yeah. I started to make you a list of all of the names and dates, and I didn't get it finished. This one thing will get you started a little bit. Let's see if we can find who are the children of Leah, and tell me what their names mean if you can. Extra credit. Firstborn, Reuben. Okay.
Simeon.
Okay. Well, Reuben means see a son. Simeon means heard. God has heard. How about Issachar? Means wages. Zebulun, dwelling. Judah, Steve mentioned Judah. That's pretty awesome that the Savior of the world's coming down through Leah and through Judah. How about Levi? They're going to be the head of the priesthood right away. Two of these boys are exceptional in the future of Israel. A daughter?
Dinah.
Inventor of pancakes, I think. Dinah's pancakes used to. Okay, now then, let's see what happens next. We have a contract that at the end of 7 years of hard work that Rachel was legitimately Jacob's and they could be married and live happily. And, oh, by the way, since the custom in that time is if you marry a daughter, you toss in a maid, you know, free, who can do all the things that maids do, and you know, dishes and laundry and babysitting and things like that. So what happens next? We're going to get Rachel. Rachel gets to be legitimately, legally married to Jacob, so he has two legal wives now. And then, along with the with Leah, is a handmaiden whose name is
Bilhah.
And there's another handmaiden in here too called Zilpah. So there's four wives, children of Zilpah. I'm reading my notes, so you don't have to know them. Gad and Asher. Gad means a troop. Asher means happy. Asher's a nice Jewish name. Bilhah.
Dan,
judge. Dan's a lot of trouble for Israel later on. That's how the betrayal to the enemy comes in. And Bilhah has a Dan and Naphtali. Naphtali means my wrestling. And we get Rachel finally has some children, as four, and she ends up with one very special son,
Joseph.
And we'll run on to him in a very important role a little bit later on in Genesis. Benjamin?
The baby.
The baby, yep. Last son of my right hand. Ephraim and Manasseh are the sons of Joseph. So later on in the Bible, Joseph is frequently replaced by his sons. Okay? Now, what do you think about this? Is this behavior unhealthy psychologically, emotionally? Is it wrong? Is all this way of doing things, is it morally wrong? Is it against the Ten Commandments? We don't have the Ten Commandments yet given. What is your opinion? Is this a dysfunctional family unit? Yes, indeed it is. It's not the kind of family that God would have built if he was really consulted in all this. The obedience of people back in these early days is a little bit here and there, hit and miss. They're not as accountable as we would be because they haven't been given as much.
I think one of the things the family story continually reminds you of is the consequences of either living by faith and then not living by faith. Mm-hmm. Just as when you know, Abraham and Sarah didn't stop believing and had, so they said, well, let's have Hagar have a child.
Yeah.
And then, okay, and then you've got lifelong, multi-generational consequences of not living by faith, and that is seen also in the lives of their children as they repeat. So that's a witness to us that we're walking by faith and we'll make a bad decision. We're forgiven, but we get to live with the consequences.
The consequence engine runs on and on and on and on.
Yeah, this is,
you can jump if you want, John.
I can do a lot of things, but I won't.
This seems to be an example of sort of the origin of warrioring, because when Jacob said, okay, my time's up, give me my wife, if he had said, give me Rachel, he would have gotten Rachel. But he said wife, and therefore he was taken advantage of, because Laban then said, okay, technically, in our culture, it's the eldest daughter. So
it's a good idea to have a strong prenuptial agreement here and a good attorney in on the front and get the wording all down correct if you're dealing with somebody that's devious and not trustworthy. So, okay, now let's please.
I noticed that you didn't use the term sinful behavior, but, since the Ten Commandments weren't given yet, I just etches up as human behavior.
Yes.
You didn't ask the question, is it sinful behavior? But in our culture, this day and age where we have the Word of God, this kind of thing would be sinful behavior. But in that day and age, maybe it was acceptable.
But how about God's position on this? If we could see God looking at the situation. All those actions that people take that are by faith in dependence on Him will invoke God's participation, and He will be working in our best interest. All those things that we do in our own selfish interest have got all the things that selfishness does to us that are negative. So I think that in the overall picture, yes, I would say that this is a pretty sinful family.
I have a question. being that these are all...
God isn't... God isn't writing it down on a calendar. The main effect is going to be in the consequences that run out. And later on, when they look back, that... Okay, I'm sorry, excuse me.
I have a question. Since all these are such godly men, and even though the Ten Commandments haven't been presented to them, wouldn't they have an inner sense of wrong in having all these wives? I mean, just common sense would tell you that when you get more than one woman in the house, there's going to be competition and rivalry and jealousy and all these things. No wonder they're all dysfunctional.
The human race is not very old. We've got a whole bunch of trial and error arrangements that are being made by these patriarchal families where the man has authority and the women don't have very much of a role. Randy.
So Laban's family is following exactly the customs of the people and the area. So having the servant wives and multiple wives and things like that is completely consistent with all the same ancient Near East customs that were contemporary and are written about in some of the other literature from the same period.
Lots of people in Babylon after the flood, diversifying, buying into the religion of Nimrod. What fraction of the people that came off of the ark are paying attention to what Noah wanted them to know, which would be both doctrine and behavior? It'd be what you believe and how you walk with God would be that's what Noah would want to get across the family. It lasts a generation or two, and then everybody sort of lapses. I think it's the problem. We have it too.
Just back to the multiple wives thing. We may not be able to make a good case for it being sinful, but it was at least stupid.
And many of you have multiple wives here today.
To reflect back on Mary's comment, I was told that the Chinese symbol for quarrel are the symbols of two women under one roof.
That's fascinating. Yeah, how can one man give himself to more than one woman wholeheartedly? This is terribly unfair to the women, and they're badly neglected and mistreated in this process where it's allowed. Missionaries go into remote parts of the world and they'll convert people who have multiple wives. And there's always a decision of, do you split this guy up and have him back down to only one wife, or does he keep all four, say? I think a lot of the time the missionaries would allow the man to keep four, since that's the family's functioning that way. And you'd make an allowance for it. In the ancient world, women who weren't married were not guaranteed a livelihood. And that means that you might force women to life of prostitution or destitution unless there's a man there to feed them. And that, so you'd have all these slave girls and maids that come and work practically for free because you got put food on their table.
There was a teaching recently on David and Abigail that might refer back to some of this multiple wife stuff. And that was, he fell in love with Abigail. And then once he married her, the idea came into his mind that, okay, I've conquered her. There's some other gals around. I think I'll go pursue them. See, so part of that sin stuff is on the male side.
Hunter-gatherer. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Hunter-gatherer. The women are men.
Very. That's right.
Must be a symbol in Chinese for the male conquest.
Very good. Here's another. Oh, we're getting some good questions.
I heard over the radio a couple of guys commenting on this kind of thing, and they said that the male ego is such that they enjoy the chase. Once they've conquered, then they're not interested anymore.
Right.
Yeah. There was someone else with it. Oh, down here.
All I was going to say is, despite this dysfunctionality, but if you read the end story, as we now, we're fortunate to see it, we see God's grace in the end.
Yes.
Yeah, there's all kinds of problems, and I get all that. But somehow God says, you know, in eternity past, you understood that was going to happen. Mm-hmm. So you had a provision that this is going to happen, but my grace is going to be sufficient in Jesus Christ. You know?
Yes. Out of this, the tragic situation in this family, God's going to bring some higher good. Inevitably, he has to.
I think the multiple wives problem is still with us in the Middle East, is it not? And it's economic as well as cultural, in my understanding. And as far as our country is concerned, it's going on here too.
We have a great deal of an enormous amount of divorce and easy divorce, and then we'd have an awful lot of fooling around on the side of people, men who are not faithful to their wives, but they live under the same roof with their wives and
mistresses,
and that.
It strikes me that through all this, though, the men, no matter how many women they have in their harem, are responsible
for
taking care of those men.
You men are responsible for your other wives. And chapter 30. When Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she envied her sister, and she said to Jacob, "Give me children, or I shall die." Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel, and he said, "Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?" And she said, "Here is my maid Bilhah. Go into her, that she may bear upon my knees." In other words, I will adopt these children and make them my own, treat them as my own. And Jacob went into her, and Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. And Rachel said, "God has judged me and has also heard my voice and given me a son." Therefore, she called his name Dan. Judgment, remember? Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. And Rachel said, "With mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister and have prevailed." So she called his name Naphtali. What do you suppose that's all about? Mighty wrestlings, have I wrestled?
Competition.
Yeah. When Leah saw that she had ceased bearing children, she took her maid Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife. And Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a son, and Leah said, "Good fortune." So she also called his name Gad. Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a second son, and Leah said, "Happy am I, for the women will call me happy." So she called his name Asher. In the days of wheat harvest, Reuben. Who's Reuben? How old is he? Old enough to go hunting in the fields. He found mandrakes in the field. What are mandrakes? Aphrodisiac herbs, or they're supposed to be good for lapsing virility. And so the boy Reuben finds these mandrakes and takes them home. Rachel said, we're going to make good use of these. He may lie with you tonight for your son's mandrakes. Jacob came in from the field in the evening, and Leah went out to meet him and said, you must come in to me, for I have hired you with my son's mandrakes. Who else is being manipulative and superstitious? And
it's
quite a family here. Leah said, God has given me my hire because I gave my maid to my husband. So she called his name Issachar. Leah conceived again, and she bore Jacob a sixth son. And Leah said, God has endowed me with a good dowry. Now my husband will honor me because I have borne him six sons. So she called his name Zebulun. Afterward, she bore a daughter and called her name Dinah. When God remembered Rachel, and God hearkened to her and opened her womb, she conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. And she called his name Joseph, saying, may the Lord add to me another son. When Rachel had borne Joseph, Jacob said to Laban, send me away that I may go to my own home and country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I've served you, and let me go. You know the service which I've given you. But Laban said to him, if you will allow me to say so, I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me because of you. Casting lots or dice, and this he's full of superstition from pagan gods. The Lord has blessed me because of you, which should be pretty obvious. Name your wages and I will give it. Jacob said to him, you yourself know how I've served you, how your cattle have, have fared with me. You had little before I came, and it had increased abundantly, and the Lord has blessed you wherever I turned. But now when shall I provide for my own household also? It turns out, it looks as if Laban is getting a little older. It looks as if he has no sons. There's nobody to inherit his ranch. And he's going to try to manipulate Jacob into that position of being the ranch manager. But somehow we know the guy's going to try to make as much money as he can. Does that sound about right? Okay. And this is be a good time for Jacob to pack up and leave, wouldn't you think? Yeah. Now there's one of the most puzzling chapters here in the whole Bible about spotted sheep and things. Let's see if we can figure this out. What shall I give you? Jacob said. You shall not give me anything if you will do this for me. I will again feed your flock and keep it. Let me pass through all your flock. I'll make a deal. You don't have to pay me, but I'm going to take over the management of your flocks to make them optimally productive and do a little genetic shuffling here. And then he says, so my honesty will answer for me later. In the passage of time, you'll see that I'm an honest guy. Well, he's not an honest guy, but...
Go back and you missed 32.
Oh, thank you. Oh, yeah. Let me pass through all your flock today, removing from it every speckled and spotted sheep and every black lamb, and the spotted and shekeled among the goats, and such shall be my wages. There are solid color animals, and we'll pile all these up and give them to Laban, and all the animals that have spots or stripes go to Jacob. And there's just a small number with stripes, probably. And now Laban he likes the deal, but he's going to be sneaky here. He said, that day Laban removed the he-goats that were striped and spotted, and all the she-goats that were speckled and spotted, every one that had white on it, and every lamb that was black, and put them in charge of his sons. He does have some sons, but maybe they're too young to inherit. He set a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob, and Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flock. So he's done some pre-sorting in his own favor. and sent the ones he's selected out of sight, a couple of days away, so that Jacob won't realize he's been cheated again. Jacob does this strange thing. He took fresh rods of poplar and almond and plane tree and peeled white stripes in them, exposing the white of the rods. He set the rods, which he had peeled, in front of the flocks in the runnels, the watering troughs, where the flocks came to drink. And when they bred, since they bred when they came to drink, the flocks bred in front of the rods, and the flocks brought forth stripes, speckled and spotted. Jacob separated the lambs and set the faces of the flocks toward the stripe, and all the black in the flock of Laban he put his own droves apart, and he did not put them together with Laban's flock. Whenever the stronger of the flock were breeding, Jacob laid the rods in the runnels before the eyes of the flock, that they might breed among the rods. But for the feebler of the flock, he did not lay them there. So the feebler were Laban's, and the stronger Jacob's. Thus the man grew exceedingly rich. That's Jacob. And he had large flocks, men servants, and maid servants, and camels and asses, and God's blessing him in spite of the funny little way this is supposed to be happening. Now, what is going on here? Because you can find all the Bible commentaries in the world, and they have, each one has a different reason to explain that why Jacob's getting rich and Uncle Laban's not. Genetics. Some dark animals that are all one solid cover may have recessive genes for stripes and spots, so that you can breed two colored animals and get some striped or spotted offspring, and then you separate those off and give those back to Jacob, because that was the deal in the beginning. That one factor. What else? What about this taking the bark off of tree limbs and putting it down in the bottom of the watering troughs to make an interesting reflection of light? Is that doing anything magic here?
That's the early genome.
That's early genome research. That's not nothing real happening here, but Jacob's a little superstitious too, and they're both kind of got a bunch of nonsense going on. So why? Well, God's the one that's making Jacob rich, in spite of the strange method. What else? It sounds as if Jacob is behaving himself day by day in the agreement, which is a little unusual for him. And it sounds as if Laban is usual self. And now we find out that he's got some secret idolatry, that he's not a strong believer. We don't know anything much more about the immediate family there. Okay? Yes.
That's superstition. It would be like today, if I would go down and trust what a psychic tells me and ignore the word of God.
Absolutely, superstition. Do you think there are farmers and animal raisers that have little superstitions running down through generations today? Sure. Like anybody think of some? Some of them are just harmless, innocent things that your grandmother told you. Except in this case, there's real idolatry here. Yes?
The divining rod comes to mind. Farmers trying to
find water. Yeah, I've met a lot of these guys and taken their divining rod and compared it with what a good electronic instrument will show. Can you find water with a divining rod? No, you can't. But there are individuals who seem to be able to get positive readings again and again and again where there is water. I wouldn't hire one because they're not reliable, but in those, quite fairly often they are successful, more than you'd expect. And I expect in those cases you may have some demonic forces running.
I know a lot of farmers that swear by the farmer's almanac.
Oh, yes.
And that has to do with astrology, the position of the stars and the moon.
That's a great old book if you've ever seen one at your grandparents' house up there. It tells you when to plant your crops, and it tells you what the weather is going to be months ahead of time, and it's a bunch of old folk ideas, and as you say, astrology is in there. It's still published, I think.
Yeah. I was going to say.
No. Please. Got two at a time.
I was just going to ask, is there an app for that? On the Palmer's Almanac, is there an application on the
For your iPhone? I don't know. You'll have to look that up. What do you want to predict?
Weather.
Over here, Doug.
Oh, just a second. Winston Churchill apparently used astrology for menial things that he didn't want to have to think about too much, like appointments and that stuff. So he could concentrate on the bigger things. I don't think he ever believed
in Nancy stuff. Reagan was brought in as an astrologer during the time when her husband was going through a lot of political stress. That came out in a little bit of a scandal.
I recently heard a teaching on this very idea, which was real interesting. So it said, when you look at verse 12, God actually made a special point of giving Jacob a dream so that he could correct that idea in Jacob's mind that he had used sorcery or this folk method to get a higher yield in his flocks. And the key word, I think, is the word for.
I'm
looking at verse 12.
Chapter 30?
31, I think.
Oh, 31.
Yeah, you're reading ahead a little, which is
good. That's good. You're supposed to read ahead. We'll have those tests.
Says, you look at you have all these sheep in your flock now, but, and then he says, for or because I have seen.
Chapter 31, verse
12
says, and he said, that's Jacob. He said, lift up your eyes and see all the goats that leap upon the flock are striped, spotted, and mottled. For I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. Oh, that's God saying to him in a dream. God comes to him in a dream and says, I know you're being cheated, and I'm watching over you. That's neat, isn't it?
Yeah.
That God's kind of overruling it. Make sure you're treated fairly. That could happen. It would be wonderful if that was happening in a job where you were overworked and underemployed, which everybody is, and you know God's taking care of you favorably, which that's really so. Okay, where did I stop?
End of 30.
End of verse 30.
No, end of chapter
30.
We did get to the end of the chapter. It meant it's time to quit.
Yeah.
Any thoughts here on this? I think you really have to pull off and look at the totally different culture, family dynamics, things going on, and yet the same kind of human nature that we have, same fallen, deceitful, manipulative. It's kind of reassuring, isn't it, that this is our forefather. You can have the afternoon.
I'm fired.
Yeah.
I'm fired. Well, I guess this would be our extra credit homework for the week, is to try to figure out in 30, with all the spotted and the speckled, if this is Jacob trying to work another angle, or if this is a demonstration of him actually trusting God. As Sally's point, it turns out that God had seen how he was being mistreated.
I think he's working another deal, but he hasn't thought about it very.
Yeah, it's just hard to understand what deal he's working with all these rods and stuff.
Yeah. Right. Do we have a hymn?
Yes, we do.
Good, thanks, gang. We'll see you in 2 weeks, and you can read ahead. Please read ahead. It's getting to be very exciting now.
And the Farmer's Almanac has a website.
They do? Okay. Oh, gosh. Where have I taken
it? I didn't know it was demonic. Anyway, we're going to sing hymn number 3. Praise my soul, the King of Heaven, to his feet a tribute bring. Ransom healed, restored, forgiven, ever.
Lord, first let me thank you that it was Cynthia leading that hymn. And thank you for how you gifted her. And I thank you again for Lambert and our time in your word. And I am struck by the consequences of not trusting you, and yet you redeem, as we'll find out later, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And we thank you that that's true. But we do want to walk by faith and not make those choices where we feel we have to intervene to get what we want, where we live in a way that seems to say that we don't trust you or we don't think you're able to provide for us. So would we use these lessons, Father, and understand what it means to trust you more each day. And let us not be too quick to sit in judgment of those patriarchs without first examining our own lives and see our own failings. But thank you again, Lord, for grace and forgiveness and the power of your Spirit in us to live by faith. And so bring us back safely next week, should you tarry that long. In Jesus' name, amen.
How you doing, my friend?
I want to tell you, thank you for your teaching.
Is this helpful?
Appreciate
you like that.
I appreciate
your rambling.
I wish you'd get your stuff online. So
it's almost ready. I'll
hurry. I don't have much time, man.
I don't either. We're going, Bob. We're going together.
I don't have much
time. Yeah, a covenant.
Well, Robert, how are you?
Well, you look like Happy Father's Day.
Wow.
Sometimes with a lot of terms in it, with covenant is more like I'm going to do this and you're going to do that. It's more of a hard.
So agreement, the covenant being more forceful.
Yeah, and if you're covenanting with God, he's going to lay down the law and he's going to say this.
And then would come your agreement.
And then would come, his agreements are to give you protection.
Thank you. And thank you for the booklet. I love it.
Relationship.
It's kind of this way, it's a reminder for me.
It's bounded. You know that you're protected, and it's from your benefit. So, agreement has that, to me, has that direction. Maybe you can negotiate it.
So you take the negotiation out of agreement, you get covenant.
I think so.
I like that.